So I haven't known Greg long, but I've gotten to know him and his wife, Kimya. And we had dinner recently for fellowship at Akraba's, and I can say that he's a great guy and walks the talk. So with that, I introduce Greg.
Thanks for such kind words. My name is Greg. I'm an alcoholic. Really appreciate you guys braving the baseball game and the 85 collapse situation to get to a meeting tonight. That's pretty good. My sponsor says that anytime I get the opportunity to speak and tell my story, share my experience, strength, and hope, that I should probably read something from the literature so I can minimize the amount of crap that comes out of my mouth. So I'm going to start with that. And, you know, when I was on my way over here, I was thinking about Step 12. And one of my favorite books is 12 and 12. I love it. It's the good stuff. You know, it's really the meat and potatoes for me. And I can really appreciate the extent and the depth of what it really talks about in there. And if applied, man, it's a really powerful, awesome thing, awesome tool. So I want to read the first paragraph in the 12 and 12. It says, the joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and action is its key word. Here we turn outward toward our fellow alcoholics who are still in distress. Here we experience the kind of giving that asks no rewards. Here, we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. When the 12th step is seen in its full implication, it is really talking about the kind of love that has no price tag on it. So, like I said, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to stick to the script, so I'll tell you about what happened. But I'll give you a preference. You know, my sobriety date is July 6, 2006. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor guys. So, I'm trying to do the deal one day at a time. This is my big book. I think it's awesome. The duct tape really works. Man. This thing's been through a lot. I love it. You know, what happened was I was born, and it got weird. It really did. My first memory as a child, I don't remember how old I was, but I had a cousin whose birthday was the day before mine, so I never really got to fully celebrate my birthday on my own. It was always like a conglomerate deal, you know, where I was just a part of a line of other people who had birthdays around the same time that I did, you know. But I was rather young. I probably should have been too young to even remember this because I don't remember being able to walk yet. But I remember being at my uncle's house, and I'm just kind of laying there, and my grandmother made this birthday cake, and it had my cousin's name and my name. That's it. It was a coconut cake, and I like coconut cake now. It's probably no surprise. That was my first cake. You know, I guess, you know, growing up, I had an older sister. She was 6 years older than me, and her thing was that, you know, I wasn't really one of the family. I was adopted, according to her, and I didn't look like them. I didn't talk like them. I didn't act like them. And I was different. And she treated me as such. She was a bully. And she tortured me for probably the first 13 years of my life. Fun at times, sad at others. But we're past it now. We have a great relationship. But that relationship really kind of fed into how I related to other people in the real world because I took those same things that I learned from her out there and I treated other people that way. And I'll get to that. But I was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And if you guys have never been to Baton Rouge, you're not missing anything. On Saturdays when LSU football season is going on, it's a great town to be in. It's awesome. But other than that, pretty much every other day of the week, it's not much going on. Not much going on. It's a lot slower than Atlanta and a lot smaller. But I liked it. I had a lot of friends there. And it was my world to explore. You know, when I was a little kid, I used to leave home. And the supervision was very low in my household. I grew up in a single-parent home. And my mom worked most of the time two jobs. So we had a lot of free time on our hands. And being that my sister was a lot older, she really didn't like me too much. I can pretty much do whatever I wanted when she wasn't around. You know, so I would go out with my friends, and it was kind of like, what's that movie with the little kids that wandered around? They found the dead body.
Goonies.
No.
Stand by me.
That's kind of how we hung out. You know, we'd explore, you know, and, you know, I don't think we ever found a dead body, but we did get shot at. Baton Rouge a little wild, you know, but yeah, it was kind of like that. You know, so we would explore the little town where we lived, and we would be all over the place, man. And we'd come home by dark, and, you know, and I'd come inside, and they wouldn't even know that I had been, like, halfway across town and back. You know, I'd smell like I'd been halfway across town and back, but, you know, my mom would never ask any questions, never dug too deep. It was kind of like one of those family dynamics where, you know, I would get in trouble when things came up to the surface that she found out about, but other than that, and she wouldn't really dig too deep, you know. So fast forward a little bit, and I was about 13 years old, and, well, 12, and I was getting ready, we were getting ready to move to Atlanta. My uncle is, he's a musician, and he had been living up here for a while, and he's in a pretty popular band, and he had been trying to get us to come to Atlanta and change, you know, have a change of pace, you know, start a new life. Because things were really rough out there. It was really hard for my mom to find a good job and, you know, be able to support my sister and I. And he decided that if she would come out here, he would help her. So we packed up everything we had, which wasn't that much. We moved to Atlanta. And when we first moved out, my sister didn't make the trip. Her and my mom got into it, and she got kicked out. She was trying to be an adult when she was a teenager kind of thing, and didn't really work the job well with my mom, and they had their heads, they butted heads, and she put her out. And so my mom and I moved up here alone. And we moved into Cobb County in 1989 in East Cobb. And it was quite different then in East Cobb. You know, very interesting. And so I'll just put it like this. I had a very difficult time adjusting to how things were going on out there. And I got in a lot of trouble. I didn't make much school because I'd spent a lot of time suspended or written up sitting in the office. I think in seventh grade, I got written up 47 times. Eighth grade, I got written up 52 times, and I got expelled with two weeks of school left. So the behavior pattern was there. You know, but I hadn't had a drink, you know, but I was sure acting like I did. And my mom sent me back home, and my whole job at that point was to work my way back to Atlanta because, you know, in spite of all the drama that was going on, I really liked it more than being in Baton Rouge and a lot more than having to live with my grandmother because she didn't take anything like my mom did, you know, like, I had to be in the house before the streetlights came on. You know, I had, you know, if I left my books at school, I had to go get them, you know, whether that was on my bike or by foot. You know, it was serious, very structured there, and I didn't like it at all. So I worked my way back to Atlanta. I came back to Atlanta, and I went to a pretty good high school, had fun, and I got involved in sports, and that kind of took away the devious activity. I was constantly involved in sports and stayed in that. And it kept me really busy. I was doing sports all year round, whether it was track, cross country, basketball, you know, weightlifting, all that stuff. I just really stayed focused. So the entire time that I was in high school, I was preoccupied by sports during the summer, you know, getting ready for the school year, you know, and, you know, during the school year, getting ready for each season. And I did pretty good, you know. I did really well. Got me a track scholarship to go to college, and I went, you know, and I had fun. And well, when I got to college, things were a little different. I went to HBCU. For those who don't know, that's a historically black college or university. And I went to Morehouse. And coming from East Cobb and going to Morehouse, it was kind of weird, you know. I had gotten used to this whole multicultural kind of thing that I was experiencing. And being a good athlete, you know, people are a little bit more accepting of you. And I, you know, had a lot of friends, you know, a lot of great relationships that I developed in high school. And when I got to this college where it was like, you know, 99.9% black dudes, it was just, it was strange to me. And I had a really hard time adjusting. And they tend to point it out too, you know. I think when I first went there, my freshman year, we didn't have any phones in the dorm room. We had to use the hall phone. We take turns using the hall phone. And I was on the phone with my girlfriend, and one of the guys passed by. He was like, "It's a white girl in it," and I was like, "Damn, how does he know?" You know, you know, they could just see it on me that something was different, you know. And that made me really uncomfortable. And I was a bit of a late bloomer because I got expelled in the eighth grade. So, you know, when I got to college, I was 20. You know, so I was a lot older than most of the other freshmen in college. And I hadn't done half the things that they had already done. You know, sports, like I said, preoccupied my life. I mean, like, I had friends in high school that drank and they did other stuff, but they never brought that stuff around me. I never had to even deal with that kind of stuff. I was never invited to any of those parties. First of all, I was a hopeless romantic in high school. I always had a girlfriend, and I was focused on that more so than hanging out with my friends and all that stuff. You know, I didn't have a whole lot of time. Sports and girlfriend was my life, and then I had a job, you know. So when I got to college, things just got turned upside down, man, and I had a really hard time fitting in. And on my 21st birthday, I drank for the first time. And I was proud of myself because I was able to go to the store, buy it myself, and consume it legally. And I had this whole picture in my mind of how things were going to play out and how much fun it was going to be. But I had never drank before, so I had to call upon some old, you know, resources. And the only thing that I can really remember was a Snoop video where they were drinking 40s. I think it was gin and juice, and he was riding on a bicycle, and I think he was on the handlebars, and he had a 40-ounce in his hand. And that was my, like, okay, so Snoop drank a 40, so I'm going to get a 40-ounce. And that was my logic. Literally, that's exactly how I thought. I was like, this is what I'm going to do. You know, so I walk in there, and I go back there, and I get it. And we go outside, and I got my cousin who's visiting from Louisiana, my roommate, which is one of my best friends now, and a couple other guys from school that lived in my dorm. And we're standing out in the parking lot, and these guys had all drank before, you know, so they knew the routine, you know, they knew how to conduct themselves, but this was my first time, and I remember cracking it open and taking a sip, and it was kind of like this. And it was disgusting. And today, this is how I know I'm an alcoholic, because the first thought that came to my mind was not put it down. It was, well, you better hurry up and drink this thing because you're not going to like it. So I that's exactly what I did. I turned the whole thing back and I drank that entire 40 ounce, and then I went back into the store and I bought another one. You know, fast forward a blackout, and a few hours later, at the school I went to, it was kind of like a thing to do. It was like Freaknik every weekend. If you guys are from Atlanta, you know what Freaknik is. If you ever got caught in traffic unwantingly, you know, or have had Freaknik imposed upon you, you know, just some random weekend, you're driving through downtown and the traffic just comes from nowhere. People are dancing on their cars and, you know, acting crazy. This was like weekend for us, and we had this little mall, West End Mall, still there, where we would go, and this is where the college kids would kind of mix with the city folk, and it would be like this big block party. So we're out there at this huge block party, and it's like gridlock traffic all around the mall. You literally had to leave your car on the road and just walk around, you know. And we were walking around, and at some point throughout the night, we had gotten to this place where it was right by a bank, and we were pulling into the bank parking lot because we were going to go into this little club. And as soon as we pulled in, some cops accosted us, you know, as if we were doing something wrong. And when they approached us, I was sitting on the window sill, the window pane of the car with the window down with my arms on the roof of the car. And my cousin and my friend, that was my roommate at the time, were literally laying on the hood of the car. And somebody else was driving. And we were turning off the road, you know. And we didn't think anything was wrong with that. You know, we were hanging out, this, you know, kids being kids. But in the city of Atlanta, evidently you can't do that. You know, you can't be hanging outside of the car. They consider two people sitting on the hood of a car obstruction to the driver's control of the vehicle. And we got arrested. So that was my birthday. I got arrested the first night I drank, and I spent the night in jail. And that's kind of how, like, that's the story of my life for the next 9 years. That was it. Eventually, school became not so much of a priority. I ended up getting hurt my sophomore year in college, so ended up voiding my scholarship, which led to more drinking. I had more free time. You know, I didn't have to be a responsible athlete. I didn't have anywhere to be at 4 a.m. every morning and 2 practices a day and all that stuff, so I partied. And I had a great time until the alcohol started taking away certain aspects of my life, like my ability to hold down a job, to be in a relationship with anybody, whether it was my guy friends or my girlfriend or my parents, you know, or my sisters. You know, it really started to weigh on me. And by the time I was 27, I had been in enough trouble that I could not legally get a job because of my background. I had one semester yet left of college that I had not completed, and I had racked up about $60,000 in student loans because I was kind of going all year round because I'd have to take classes over because I just was not going to class, you know. So I was really just spinning my wheels, you know, in college, and eventually they just put me. They told me that I had to go, you know. And that's when things got real, and I ended up living in Midtown. I don't know how I was able to manage. I got a job working valet. I didn't even have a driver's license. But I was parking people's cars at a 5-star hotel for about 3 years. And I was not sober the entire time. It seemed like a lot of fun then, but now that I really think about it, it's crazy. It's absolutely insane how I was living. And, you know, something happened, you know. At some point, things started to change, and what it was like was that it was like Groundhog's Day every day. It was a chore, literally, to get up, you know, in the morning, you know. And I had to take the night shift because I couldn't get up before 12:30, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. And I would work the 3 to 11 shift, and then I'd make money. And then every single night, it was the same routine. I'd go, and I'd blow all my tips at a strip club or, you know, at a club, you know, and then I'd be miserable on the way back home, taxi, friend's car, walking, whatever, like trying to figure out how in the heck did I do this again, you know? And it was like 7 days a week, the same exact thing. And one day I was having a soiree at my loft. It was it was a Sunday afternoon. I hadn't been asleep, and I had a bunch of people over, and we were having a pretty good party. And I got a knock on the door, and it was my parents. They hadn't seen me in probably, they used to do drive-bys when I was working at the hotel just to see me working on the front drive. But at this point, our relationship, we were not talking too much, so they would just pass by just to check and see if I was alive, you know, just to see if I was okay. Okay, he's there, he's working, he's fine. But this particular day, for whatever reason, they showed up, and they told me that they made me an offer. They were like, you know, we'll put you up someplace if you, you know, quit drinking. And I thought that I could do it, you know, and I was tired anyway, so I decided that I'd go with them. And I moved out of that place, and I moved to the west side of town, and that's when things got really bad, because I didn't have anything. I was just isolated, stuck in this place where I couldn't relate to anybody, and I was miserable, you know. And the persona that I had created for myself, you know, what I like to tell myself, that I was this, you know, because of course, you know, in my story, you know, that valet parking was not the only way that I made my money. I had other things going on, and the hotel was a very good place to do that. Had a nice little enterprise going, but when I moved away from there, all that was gone. And what I thought I was, I found out that I was one of the people that I treated a certain way. I was exactly like them. You know, I was an addict. You know, there are people that come to me and ask me for stuff, and I cut them off. Like, I was that guy. You know, and when I realized that, I was in a lot of pain, but I couldn't stop. But the crazy part is that the stuff that I was using, it wasn't working anymore. You know, I couldn't get as drunk. You know, it took a lot more effort on my part to even get halfway there. And finally, I got to a place on the 4th of July in 2006, went over to my parents' house, and my parents, they don't drink. My sister doesn't really drink. She might drink a half a Long Island iced tea, and she's wasted. She's done, you know. And my brother-in-law, he's a drinker, but he's not like me. He can still function, get up and go to work, do his thing, you know, and he can put it down whenever, you know. And I show up to this place, and I got a case of Budweiser and a bottle of Crown Royal, and I'm by myself. You know, this is what it's going to take for me. And when I left there, I had about a six pack left, and the crown was gone, you know. And I went to my parents were they had a small apartment complex that I lived in, and I managed. They just basically gave me a job to kind of keep me busy, keep me preoccupied. And I went into one of the vacant apartments, and I did some other stuff. And then I went to sleep, and I woke up the morning of July 5th, and I wanted to kill myself. I was done. And I remember sitting in my truck, like, trying to make a wager with God, you know, like, you know, because I didn't have the courage to do it myself, you know. I had a gun, and I thought I wanted to use it, but I couldn't. And I remember for the first time in my life, I always respected God. I never cursed him or anything like that. But this particular day, I did. I was so mad. And that was my prayer. It was not the nicest prayer. It's probably the craziest thing I've ever said, you know, to something like that, to a power like that. But it worked. And at the end of it, I said, you know, if I make it through this night, I'll go get some help. You know, and I went home, and I fell asleep. And the next morning, I woke up, and I just started packing my stuff. And I went to rehab I went to detox for 6 days. I showed up at Cottage C because I saw it on the commercials in high school. And I knew a couple kids from high school that had gone there. and I checked myself in, and I stayed there for 6 days, and then I checked out, and I went to a halfway house and a full-on outpatient program, and that's kind of how this journey started for me. I was introduced to AA at Cottage C at a CA meeting, actually, and I picked up my only white chip there, and I thought you guys were crazy. But then I later realized that I was in a mental institution, and that's probably why I thought everybody was crazy. You know, we were all crazy. And when I got out, one of the requirements at the program I went to was we had to go to 5 meetings a week. And I went to we were in Buckhead off Lenox Road, and I found this clubhouse called Triangle, and I started going there. And that place saved my life. You know, I didn't really know what I wanted from AA, but I had done so much damage here in the city, I really needed a place to hide, you know, and Triangle was a good spot, you know. I didn't have to worry about people that I was doing business with to find me there. So I camped out there. I would go get up, and I'd go to my IOP classes, and then after that, they'd drop us back off by like 2, 2.30 in the afternoon, and I'd walk up there or catch the train, and I'd sit up there, and I'd go to a meeting at 4. I'd go to the 5:45. I'd go to the 8, and then I'd go to the 10, you know, and I would just sit in the furthest corner away from the speaker and just kind of just sit there. You know, I wasn't even on the coffee thing yet. I didn't trust you guys too much, but I would just sit there and I'd listen, you know. And I remember thinking, like, man, this stuff, it just sounds too good to be true. Something's not right about these people. They cannot be this happy. They cannot be, you know, this adjusted to this lifestyle as they say they are. Something, they're doing something. And I decided that I was going to stick around and try to figure out what it was that you guys were doing, because it definitely, in my mind, it definitely wasn't just staying sober. It had to be more to it than just that, you know. And so I stuck around, and, you know, some people encouraged me that I should probably get a sponsor if I was going to be going to that many meetings, and that I should probably help out if I was going to be there all day smoking and, you know, doing the things that, you know, I'm out here littering. And it was a lady, she came up to me after a meeting, and I was like, man, the audacity of this woman to come to me and approach me and tell me that if I'm going to be around here, I should probably help out, you know. And I did. And I learned a lot, you know. I was there early, so the first thing I started to do was I started making coffee. And I realized that being a coffee guy at a place where a lot of people come in and out, people, especially if you make good coffee, they get to know you. And they're excited to see you when they show up. They want to talk to you. You know, they're energized about, you know, they're enthusiastic about having conversations with you. And doing that, it broke the ice, and it kind of made me feel like I was a part of something, you know. And I still hadn't gotten a sponsor yet, because I was just kind of really freaked out about having to ask another dude about anything. I had daddy issues and all that stuff that I hadn't worked on yet, so I was just kind of, you know, not really interested in doing that kind of stuff. Extremely unapproachable when it came to guys. I saw this girl that I was interested in, and somebody told me that if I was going to date, I should probably try to get through the steps first. And that was probably one of the best little tidbits of advice that I had gotten, you know. So I went and I found a sponsor for all the wrong reasons. And I started working the steps with this guy. And funny thing is that the girl didn't stick around. So by the time I finished the steps, she was gone. And I had done the steps. So, you know, I had found something, you know. So I got heavily involved. You know, I just fell into this thing. I put 10 toes down into this thing, and I'm so glad that I did. I really needed it, you know, especially, you know, in the beginning. I really needed to build a serious foundation, because I came in here with a lot of prejudice. You know, nobody looked like me for the most part. I had to go to the South Side. Then that was later, in later years of sobriety, before I found groups of, you know, alcoholics that looked like me. So the first, you know, 4 or 5 years of my recovery, I felt out of place, you know. And getting involved with the groups, it made a big difference in me being able to identify that that was my stuff and that people, you guys were generally good people and you guys wanted the same thing for yourselves as well as me. And you showed me that time and time again, unconditionally. You know, it talks about in the 12 and 12, that love, you know, that that we get, you know, when we come in. And it's uncomfortable at first, you know. It's hard for me to kind of take it all in. You know, it's kind of weird. I'm not used to people approaching me like that. And I don't have the capacity to trust people in that way. But, you know, if I stick around and I do the things that you guys suggest, I can become okay with that, you know, and I can let people love me until I can love myself. And I used to think that that was like one of the most just cliche things, you know, but it was true, you know, like if these people that I showed up, when I showed up to Triangle, if these people had not taken an interest in me and pushed me out of my comfort zone, you know, time and time again, I don't know if I would have stuck around. You know, maybe I would. It would have been really easy for me to back out and sneak out the back door. I was already sitting in the back of the room. You know what I mean? And you know what it's like. What it's like today, man. I love AA. It's a lifesaver. You know, and this is what it's all about for me, because you know, through everything that I've experienced, even from the, like from early on, I remember. You know, after I got this thing and I felt it in my heart and I knew that it worked, the one thing I really wanted to do was I wanted to give it to somebody else. So I would try, like, you know, I'd be raising my hand in meetings like, you know, man, you know, I need to get me a sponsee. You know, I need to get somebody to work with, you know, and I wanted to tell the world how powerful this was, you know, and I had to learn some patience, you know. My first sponsee didn't work out so well. The second sponsee went back out and overdosed, and it scared the heck out of me. You know, in a halfway house on the couch, you know, and I had to hear from his roommates that he had died. You know, and it was terrifying. You know, I thought that I had something to do with it. You know, man, I probably shouldn't be sponsoring guys. Man, I'm killing them. You know, and you know, and I really felt like that. You know, and, you know, and a guy told me, man, you know, there's, you know, AA is so much stronger than that. There's nothing you can do to AA to break it, you know. And I remember hanging on those words, and I just hung in there. And you know, months went by, and I didn't have a sponsee, and I was just, you know, kind of starting to doubt that I would find somebody who wanted to work with me. And then something happened. I stopped looking. And then somebody showed up. And they were like, can you help me? What? Can you help me? You know? And I was like, yeah. You know? And that's where, like, I thought that I had felt, like, the true feeling of the power of what AA has to offer when I got that first dose of it. You know, my sponsor gave it to me. But that was nothing, absolutely nothing, in comparison to the feeling I got when I was able to take that first guy through the steps, you know, and watch him get sober and watch his life just start to develop right before both of us, you know. And that guy's still sober today. It's amazing, you know. He's like a little grown man. You know, it's so weird, you know. And then after that, you know, more and more guys started to come, and I would say yes and yes and yes and yes and yes and yes. But, you know, what I really want to focus on about that is that, like, life happens. I never know when something's going to come up that's going to shake my foundation, that's going to disrupt my flow, you know, or get me, you know, or a pothole that I'm going to hit that's going to bust my tire, you know. This stuff just happens, you know, and if I'm not actively in the process, some of that stuff can knock me off the beam, you know. There was a lot of reservations that I came in here with, you know, that, like, I said that if these things happened, I might drink over them, you know. And had I not been fully engaged in the process, I probably would have. But, you know, being connected, being in the middle of the bed, you know, this, a guy that I met in L.A., you know, he said something to me that I thought was so profound, and I still carry it with me today. He said, you stick around the edge of this thing long enough, you'll get picked off. You know, and I really like that because I'm a visual person. I can visualize that, you know. So, like, my mission is to try to work my way into the middle of this thing. And in doing so, when these challenges come up, when these life events come up, you know, I'm in the middle of the process. And the last thing that I think about is going and getting drunk. You know, one of the things that I think about is, like, how can I be of service? What kind of solution can I bring to this situation? You know, and that's not me. That's not how I was wired. You know, that's something that I learned here in AA. You know, and I'll give you an example. I remember a lot of my issues, I'll preface this by saying a lot of my issues, especially early on, were revolved around women, you know. And I'll just leave that at that. But I was dating this girl, and we had had an awesome weekend. And on that weekend, the Friday prior to us going out of town, we went to the Smoky Mountains and got a cabin and hung out. I talked to my grandmother. And one of the things I was supposed to do before I left there was I was supposed to go see my grandma. You know, we had been talking about it. Grandma had been like a trooper. She was so awesome. You know, she helped me when my parents were, like, you know, judging me and didn't quite understand me. She had that unconditional love that you guys showed me. She was a perfect example of that. She was the first example of that. You know, and we talked. And she was like, don't worry. Go out and have fun. Just come see me when you get back. You know, and I'm driving back that Sunday with this girl. And I started out by saying this, my girlfriend. I'm driving back on Sunday with this girl. Because that trip didn't work out so well. And on the way, one of my sponsees called me. And he was like, man, I'm really struggling. Can we meet up? And all I really wanted to do was kind of go sulk in the drama that I had dealt with that weekend. But something told me to go and sit with this guy. And I got her to drop me off, asked him if he can take me home. Got her to drop me off at the Starbucks, and we sat down and we talked. And we were talking, and we were just about done. And I got a phone call from my sister. And since I was with a sponsee, I pushed it to voicemail. She kept calling me back. So finally answered the phone. What's going on? Grandma died. You know? And I was like, wow. You know? And I part of me didn't even realize how fresh it was. You know? And I was in the area. And my sponsee, he was like, man, what's going on? I told him what happened. I was like, you know, I think I need to go to my uncle's house. And I didn't realize that my uncle had literally just discovered her in the bed. And she was laying there asleep, and she had a Bible in her hand. She was just cuddled up in the bed, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, well, at least that wasn't a struggle. You know, she looked so peaceful. And for me, I was okay with that. It hurt like hell. But had I been in a different space, I don't know if I would have been able to deal with that situation the way that I was able to, you know. But I honestly believe because I was engaged in the process, that situation was, I was able to be the son that my mom needed. I was able to be the brother that my sister needed. I was able to be the grandson that did all the things that people just could not do because of their emotions or because of their feelings or because of their finances. I was able to do all those things, and it's only by the grace of God, you know, and this program that I was able to insert myself into those situations, because I wouldn't have done that if I wasn't sober, You know, like, that would have been, I would have been so far gone, they wouldn't have even called me to tell me, you know. And, you know, I have so many countless other situations where, you know, it's given me so much respect for this program and proof that this stuff really does work, you know, when I do it. You know, I'm a living example of what this program does, you know, because I'm not supposed to be here, you know. The things that I did in my 20s, I should still be in jail. But for some strange reason, you know, God wanted me here, you know, and I don't take that for granted. So what I do is I try to help as many guys out of the pits of hell as I can, you know, with what was so freely given to me. You know, my first sponsor was awesome. The second guy was awesome. And even the guy that I have now that I've been with for 7 years, he's absolutely amazing. He's exactly what I needed. I knew he was my sponsor the first time I saw him, but I was too afraid to ask him because I thought he was a little rough around the edges. He was a little loud. And I didn't know in my first 62 days if I was willing to deal with that. But it's funny how things happen. I ended up with this same guy anyway, you know. And I think that's another God thing, you know. So, you know, I don't know much about a lot of things, but the one thing I do know is that, you know, this program, it really works. Even when I was at, you know, a place in my life where I even, you know, I couldn't even put the full effort in. You know, the one thing that I was able to do consistently was stick to the basics, and I made it through that. You know, prayer, meditation, working with others in meetings, you know. And even when I didn't feel like anything was happening or, you know, stuff was going on in my life, I got through those times, you know, and I came out okay. I want to read one more thing, and then I'm going to shut up. It says, now what about the rest of the 12th step? That wonderful energy it releases and the eager action by which it carries our message to the next suffering alcoholic, and which finally translates the 12 steps into action upon all our affairs, is the payoff, that magnificent reality of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that feeling I get, you know, when I'm working with somebody else, or I see one of my, you know, somebody who comes in, it doesn't even have to be a sponsee of mine. It could be somebody else. It could be Jerry's sponsee. You know, it could be anybody's sponsee. You know, to see the light come on and see somebody get better, that's the payoff. You know, that's the deal. And that's what keeps me coming back, you know. Like, one, I know this stuff works. It's been tested, you know. You know, one of the guys that I really admire, he says you have to run the experiment, you know. And when I ask questions and I buck and I doubt, he's like, just run the experiment, you know. What can it hurt if you do these things? What can it hurt? Take a little bit of your time. You know, what can it hurt? Every time I run an experiment, it works. And the other thing that I'm starting to learn now is that this stuff is applicable to anything if I'm willing to apply it. You know, and that's an awesome thing because, man, I know working out in the real world, there's a lot of people out there I wish had the 12 steps.
Yeah.
I'm just going to leave it at that. You know what I mean? So when I think about it in that way, I realize that this is really a gift. It really is, you know, and it's awesome. You know, this thing, I've been able to go to meetings all over the world. I have friends from AA all over the world, you know, and before I got sober, I couldn't even leave the state of Georgia, you know, and so I owe that to AA, this beautiful life that I have, I owe it to AA, this awesome gift that I've been given, I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can never forget that. And I'll end with this. You know, everything I am, everything that I have, I have to always remember that it can fit into a shot glass. You know, everything. No matter how much I think I've got, it'll fit in there. Thanks for letting me share.